The tragedy of drought and the tremendous human toll that it is taking and has taken in sub-Sahara Africa is nothing new, but the world became keenly aware of it several years ago when a crew from British Broadcasting visited Ethiopia and put together a special that was broadcast first in Britain and then in other parts of the world. It pictured in a way that gripped the hearts of millions of people what is happening in Africa as the Sahara Desert advances southward. As a result of that, the wave of human contribution and compassion has come in a significant way to Africa. Programs like Live Aid and Band Aid and tremendous contributions from the Tear Fund in Europe for World Vision and World Relief and Catholic Charities and a multitude of different means has poured millions of dollars into Africa with the hope of helping people who are desperately hurting. This evening in our sharing together, we focus particularly on one part of that sub-Sahara Africa that is called the Sahel of West Africa. West Africa is a Francophone area, meaning that the primary language that people speak other than their first tribal language is that of French, and once was a collection of French colonies. The problem for that particular part of Africa, notably the countries of Mali and Burkina Faso, is that they are, by most international standards, insignificant and inconsequential. They are landlocked countries, and that presents a tremendous difficulty for any country to not have a seaport. Usually that means that the country is not militarily strategic. It means that it is extremely difficult to get goods which are not readily available within the country. And for these countries, there are very, very few national resources available to them. Add to that the vast majority of the people are uneducated and unsophisticated. In many cases, they have very little mechanical skills. I heard a story while in Africa of a hydraulic air hammer system that was delivered, and before it was possible for Westerners to train the people in the use of it, they had ruined it because they did not realize that oil had to be inserted before the machinery was started up. And that type of difficulty and mentality permeates much of the system, so that even the resources that are available oftentimes are misused. Now add to that a tremendous population, add to that the advance of the Sahara Desert, which moves southward in various areas at a rate from 3 to, in some places, 15 miles per year. See what that means in terms of the dislocation of people. Add to that that there has been an erratic rainy season over past years. In some years, there has been virtually no rainy season, or when the rains come, and in some areas, the rains are, in terms of measurement, as great as they are in New York City. But when the rains come, they come all at once, and they cause tremendous erosion. So the rains fall, the water quickly runs off, and the very little and delicate topsoil that is there is washed southward toward the North Atlantic. In addition to all of these other problems that have come with drought over the last 30 years, and particularly over the last half dozen years, is the added complication that the water table in the Sahel is dropping an average of 20 inches a year. Now, I'll admit that I didn't know and still don't know a great deal about water tables and wells, although I'll show you some pictures of some tonight. But those that are knowledgeable tell me that that is virtually unbelievable, that there are trees that have been around for as long as 100 years that are now dying because their roots can no longer reach the water. Wells that have been serving villages for as long as the memory of the people now are dry. And often it's difficult for those villages to dig the wells any deeper to provide the water that they need to survive. Well, specifically, I draw your attention tonight to two countries. The first of those countries is the country of Burkina Faso. And that is probably not a country that you learned about in school, at least by that name, because on our old maps, it is better known by the name of the river that runs through Burkina Faso, and that is the Volta River. And so on our older maps, or when those of us who are a little bit older went to school, we knew the country as Upper Volta. The country was renamed with the coup of 1981 when Captain Thomas Sankara became the president of the country with the aid of arms from Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, and he renamed the country, renamed it Burkina Faso, which means the land of upright men. Burkina Faso has a land area of about 106,000 square miles, which makes it approximately the size of our state of Colorado. In that 106,000 square miles, there are somewhere around, and it is admittedly an estimate rather than a precise count, about 7 million people, 90% of whom live in an agricultural and agrarian society. Most of Burkina Faso is the Sahel. Now, the Sahel is that sub-Sahara part of Africa which variously includes savanna, which is grassland that isn't good for much of anything as far as crop growing is concerned, and brush plains and scattered hills, and a combination of seasons that is extremely wet in the rainy season and extraordinarily arid in the dry season. To give you a feel of what Burkina Faso is like, let me give to you some more statistics. For example, out of every 1,000 births, 182 children die, almost 20%. In that country, the only social security system there is, as in many third world countries, is to have children. Girls will marry at 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, and often have a child every year or every other year, sometimes having as many as 10, 15, even in some cases 20 pregnancies and births in order to have 8 or 10 or 12 children who survive. Life expectancy in Burkina Faso is 42 years, meaning that many of us who are here tonight have already exceeded the life expectancy of that country. A life expectancy that for men is longer than for women because of the particular hardships that are inflicted upon women there. Education? Well, there are different ways of measuring it. 8% of the people in the country go to school. 92% of them never attend school at all, and that has resulted in an estimated literacy of about 5%. Now, we don't really understand all of those figures, but we Americans often do understand in terms of dollars. In Burkina Faso, the average per capita income in U.S. dollars is $180 per year. Now, you think of the number of your family and multiply the number of that family times $180 and figure how your family would survive. Now, lest you think that things there must be extraordinarily less expensive than they are in America, let me assure you that things there are extraordinarily more expensive than they are in America. Fuel costs in excess of $3 a gallon. I'll show you in our pictures upcoming a picture of a liter of water that costs $5 in a restaurant. And those of us traveling in this desert-like region found that we were drinking 3 to 4 liters a day minimum. That is $15 to $20 a day just to have potable water. And yet people are barely surviving there on an average per capita income of $180 per year. The religion of Burkina Faso is interesting. Some would consider it to be a Muslim country, although only 20% of the people are Muslims. Nevertheless, in many of the villages, you can see made out of mud mosques where Muslims come to worship. 10% of the people are Christians, although the Christian church is growing rapidly, and particularly the Assembly of God, where there are about 150,000 members in the Assembly of God churches of Burkina Faso. What are most of the people then, the remaining 70%? Well, they're animists, a primitive type of religion that assumes that they're is a spirit to almost every inanimate object, and that the purpose of life is to somehow come together in harmony with those spirits so that the evil spirits don't get you and the good spirits somehow have a positive effect upon your life. Let me share with you from a briefing paper that comes out of an analysis of the situation in Burkina Faso, a couple of paragraphs that I think you'll find interesting. The village chiefs in Burkina Faso can remember other periods of drought and famine, but not even the oldest can remember when it was as severe as it has been for the past 4 years. None can remember when the Black Volta, the largest river in the country, was completely dry less than 3 months after the rainy season ended. And no one can remember the rainy season ever being so short. Many wells have dried up, leaving entire villages without water. The women must walk for miles to other villages and wait in line all day and sometimes all night for one clay pot of water. If they get out of line, they lose their place. Pastors notice that their congregations have many missing each Sunday. These are the women who must stand in the lines for water. Thousands of Burkina Bay, which is the name of the people of Burkina Faso, thousands of Burkina Bay have already died. Many are so weak from hunger they can't walk. Some pastors are too weak to stand in their pulpits. In some villages, groups of 20 to 30 young men and boys go out into the desert each morning with sticks and machetes to hunt for rats for food and usually come back in the evening empty-handed. Many people eat roots, grass, and poisoned berries from thorn bushes, berries which are edible if boiled for 7 days, but many have died because they were too hungry to wait the required 7 days, and instead they ate the deadly berries. The hardy baobab tree, for centuries the symbol of survival and longevity, are dying. Farm work animals and beef cattle fall by the dusty trails in the blazing sun, victims of starvation and thirst. The neighboring land to Burkina Faso is the country of Mali, one that is tremendously larger and by some measures richer and better, although by American standards, frankly, it also is an extremely difficult place. Mali, larger, 478,764 square miles, or to put it in reference to America, it is larger than Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico combined. There also, there are about 7 million people spread over an area more than four times the size of Burkina Faso. Those 7 million people basically come from 8 tribal groups. Infant mortality there, somewhat better. Out of every 1,000 births, about 152 babies die. Life expectancy, 3 years longer in Mali than in Burkina Faso at 45 years. Education, attendance is, again, by comparison, high. 28% of the people attend elementary school and 9% of them attend secondary school, resulting in a literacy rate double that of Burkina Faso, but still only 10%. Dollars? Well, again, if you measure in terms of U.S. dollars, you find that the annual per capita income is just $190 a year, only slightly better than their neighbor to the east. The religion of Mali is a sharp contrast to that of Burkina Faso, for the country is 90% Muslim, and so is much like many of the other countries of North Africa that are essentially Muslim in their constituency. Animists are only 9% there, but Christians are only 1%. In the area that we shall, in film, visit tonight, the Christian and Missionary Alliance has long been working and is having a significant and a successful ministry among the Dogon people. But again, let me read to you from a briefing paper from the country of Mali, and particularly the area of the Dogons. Life in the Dogon, I should explain to you that Dogon is both the name of the place and the people and the language, which I find very convenient because I have trouble remembering all the names, and when they're all the same, that's great. Life in the Dogon is difficult even under normal conditions. Now, after more than 4 years of the worst drought of this century, women must walk all day searching for water. People have resorted to digging in anthills, hoping to find a few grains of millet or seed stored there by the ants. It is common to see people eating leaves from the few remaining trees, sometimes the only food they can find. Dogons don't name their children until they're a year old, because the chance is so great that they won't survive. During the driest part of the year, Harmattan, The Harmattan winds blow away what little topsoil remains, leaving dusty, barren sand dunes in vast regions which just 15 years ago flourished with abundant crops, as well as green, shady trees and lush grass for animals grazing, and once flowed with streams full of fish and plentiful varieties of wild game and colorful birds. Although some spotty rains have recently come to the Dogon, this region, like most of the Sahel, is still too weak to feed itself. One mediocre harvest will not feed the entire region, will not allow for even a small surplus in the Dogon granaries. One season of fairly good rains will not bring the constantly dropping water level back to normal. There will be a shortfall of grain again this year because most of the people in the Dogon had no seed to plant, because they had to eat it to survive. In fact, in one of the areas visited, there was rain last year, and in that particular case, there was sufficient grain, and there was an unparalleled excitement about the crop that was coming, only to find that three different types of worms assaulted the crop, and they lost it all. The World Relief Corporation is working in Burkina Faso and Mali. WRC is a subsidiary wholly owned by the National Association of Evangelicals, of which Wooddale Church is a part. NAE has many denominations that run the whole gamut of evangelical Christianity. 40-some denominations are members. 70-some denominations have churches represented and participating, with a constituency of somewhere between 3 and 4 million people. If you sense in my comments tonight that I am sold on World Relief, then you have gotten the correct picture. World Relief operates on a budget of about $20 million, which by comparison to some relief agencies that have budgets more like $300 million, is comparatively little money. And yet, interestingly, of the $20 million of budget for World Relief, only about $5 million of it comes in contributions from churches and people like us. The rest of it comes from grants from foundations and from the governments of countries, particularly the United States and Canada. Now, one of the exciting parts of that is that for every dollar that any of us contribute to World Relief, that is multiplied out to $4 by matching contributions by government and private agencies. In some cases, it's dramatically more. World Relief has recently been awarded a project for relief in the little Central American country of Honduras. And the total project has a U.S. government contribution of $4 million on the contingency that World Relief put up $100,000 in administration expenses. Now, I'm not quite sure how that multiplies out. Unfortunately, to date, World Relief has not been able to come up with the $100,000 in order to get the $4 million in the grant that is provided. But what's most exciting about World Relief is not the dollars that are matched and spent. But what is most exciting and virtually unique about the World Relief Corporation is that it works with and through churches. Many other relief agencies work through the government or work through anyone that is available. So it's possible for us to contribute through other relief agencies and then have the government of Ethiopia or Burkina Faso or Niger or some other country distribute to the people, and admittedly to help them. But when money is contributed and food is distributed as well as other projects through World Relief, it is done through the existing Christian community and churches of the country. Churches like those with the Christian and Missionary Alliance or the Baptist General Conference in Ethiopia or the Assemblies of God in Burkina Faso. That enables, then, the whole system that is already present in churches, in pastors, in elders, in people, to, in the name of Jesus Christ, meet people's human needs. Wooddale Church has long been involved in terms of contributions with World Relief. In our 1986 evangelism or missions budget, we have earmarked $10,000. And in addition to that, in certain years, we have had special offerings which have contributed as much as $30,000 in addition to that. I consider that to be money well spent, but it is also comparatively little, both in terms of the need in the ministry of World Relief and even in the magnitude of the finances of Wooddale Church. Well, what happens in West Africa with that money and those projects? World Relief in West Africa has a 10-point program that I find to be absolutely fascinating. One part of it is free food that is given to those who are destitute. When we think of meeting human needs, we think primarily in terms of the distribution of free food. That is actually a very small part of the relief and development effort. A second part is food banks. What happens is that all the crop is harvested at the same time, and food brokers will come in and will buy up that crop at the lowest possible prices and then store it until the prices escalate long after the harvest in the dry season, and then the people with little money will have to buy back their own grain at a higher price. What eventually happens is they become so indebted to the grain brokers that the grain brokers virtually own them as slaves. World Relief moves in and builds a building and uses money to buy the grain from the people at the low price and to break the cycle with the greedy grain brokers and to then sell the grain back to the people at the same price or sometimes even at a lower price than the price at which it was originally purchased. A third program, which we will see more of in a few minutes, is food for work, where World Relief will go into a community, say, that needs a well, and ask the people to dig the well themselves and provide the necessary tools and equipment, and then pay the workers of the village and the community with food that they need in order to survive. And the Dogana Road was built that you'll see in a few minutes, completely with food that was supplied in the form of grain for people to help in their own community. Another program is supplementary food, particularly for women and children. Now, I want to share a little bit about the place and the role of women in West African society, in fact, in other parts of Africa as well, that I know from the very beginning will rub a lot of people wrong, and there will be a tendency to say, well, why don't they just do it differently? Except we know that social change in our own country comes very, very slowly. Understand that in many of these areas, polygamous marriages are the norm rather than the exception. And so a man, particularly if he is a man of importance or comparative wealth, will have three, by Muslim standards, the maximum, or more wives. Under the culture of the society, unlike ours, which say that women and children go first and most safely and have their needs met, the man is the one who is fed first. And so if there is a limited amount of food, his wife will be sure that he is well fed, even if it means that she and her baby go hungry and die. Women work unbelievably long hours. If they don't die by childbirth, many times they die by the sheer exhaustion and difficulty of the lives which they live. In one village where I stayed, I could hear the women working until midnight, and then they went to sleep and arose again at 3 o'clock in the morning, where they hauled water on their heads until dawn, and then when dawn came, they got the firewood to build the fire and worked until the heat of the day, sometime after noon, and then had a few more hours of sleep and then back to work in the late afternoon until midnight. World Relief moves into an area and provides supplementary food that is earmarked specifically and exclusively for women and children. There are set up centers that will provide medical and other types of food care for women and children. In one area of Burkina Faso, 39,000 high protein biscuits were specifically provided and fed to women and children. A fifth area is food production. My experience is that food production is not a function of people's lack of work. And if you have any type of myth that the people of poor countries are not hard workers, my only response is to say you ought to go and see them work. For I watch people working far harder than just about anyone I have ever seen working in this country. But there are adverse circumstances. There are inadequate tools. Oftentimes there is not seed, or there is a tremendous ignorance. For example, in one area where we visited, an agriculturist explained that the soil was so hard on the top that the people couldn't plant there. However, there was some better soil a little bit deeper. And my naive question was, then why don't you provide shovels for the people so that they can break up the soil, turn it over, and get the better soil over? And he explained, shovels are for people who have shoes, and these people have no shoes. And there is no way that they could ever force the shovel through the hard surface of the ground with their bare feet. The idea in food production is to provide help and tools that will work and to do it through local churches. A seventh area is training centers, where World Relief goes in and establishes a training center, usually with a garden and a farm, sometimes with a dam and a water catchment project in addition to wells, and will there train people who will live in residence for several months so that they can learn how to go back to their villages and provide different techniques for a better return from their farms. A seventh is dry season gardening. The farming season is so very short that there end up being 8 months of dry season every year when there's almost nothing for the people to do. In dry season gardening, it is possible for them through wells and through water catchment projects to have gardens where they can have vegetables not only for eating during the dry season, but also for the selling of those vegetables, which it provides a cash crop, and that cash crop in turn can be used to buy grain. A major area of World Relief projects in Burkina Faso and Mali has to do with water resources. The building of dams so that reservoirs protect the water and it doesn't just run off and cause the subsequent erosion. The provision of hand-dug wells, which are by far the most popular. Also, boreholes where equipment is brought in, as we more traditionally think of a well that is bored down. Interestingly, that creates a whole problem that we don't think of in America, because there are many villages where relief agencies have gone in past years and they have had a borehole down to the water table and they have a casing and they have a pump at the top. However, the pump years ago broke and the people have neither mechanical skill nor the money to repair the pump. So there is a well and they are dying of thirst because they have no way of getting the water out of the well. Whereas in hand-dug wells, it's possible as the water table drops to go back into the well and to lower it, as well as to bail the water out through ordinary means. One of World Relief's projects in terms of water resources is to go back into communities where there are boreholes and pumps that are broken and provide new pumps, or to fix the pumps that need repair. A ninth area is women's ministries. Women's ministries, not so much in terms of clinics and food, but women's ministries in order to change the difficult cycle for the problems that women of West Africa face. A lot of this has to do with labor-saving devices. We'll show you a picture of a mill that will mill the grain and cut hours of labor out of a woman's day and a woman's week. The men, while the women work, have a tendency to sit around in what shade can be found and to solve the problems of the world. But I found some men who, through translation, explained that if it were possible, and again, maybe this kind of rubs you wrong, particularly women, that World Relief go into an area where the women are hauling firewood, sometimes as long as miles, sometimes using half the day in order to bring firewood in for cooking. And if it's possible for World Relief to go in with a simple cart and a donkey, usually provided on credit to the people that they in turn repay over a series of years, and then that credit purchases other donkeys and carts for other villages. One of the men of the village told me that if World Relief would provide a cart, that he would be willing to go get the wood. Anyway, the women's ministries are to enable the women to have a less difficult life. And finally, spiritual ministries, including evangelism and training and helping local churches to reach out in terms of literacy and film projectors and things like that. Now, that is a part, although not a primary part, of the ministry of World Relief. Normally, that is done through the local churches and the evangelists and the missionaries of the countries, and World Relief supplements that by meeting human needs. My trip, let me tell you just for a moment or two about it, and then we'll go to the pictures. The purpose of the trip was, as the pastor of Wooddale Church and as a member of the Executive Committee of National Association of Evangelicals, which I mentioned owns and operates World Relief, to survey World Relief in its Africa work. to express on your behalf and on the behalf of the evangelical churches of America support and solidarity for our brothers and sisters in Christ in difficult circumstances. And I can hardly overemphasize how important it is and how delighted it makes those people to hear those types of greetings, as well as to report back to the church in the United States. There were four of us who traveled together to Burkina Faso and Mali. In addition to myself was Billy Melvin, who is the executive director of the National Association of Evangelicals, Don Bjork, who is the senior associate director of World Relief Corporation, and Robert Cooley, who is the president of Gordon Conwell Seminary north of Boston. Our itinerary took us on the 21st of April, took me from Minneapolis to JFK Airport in New York, where they were waiting and where my plane arrived as the transatlantic flight was boarding. So just made it. I was over the airport an hour before that. It just took a while to get my feet on the ground. And then having arrived in New York and took off quickly on a Pan Am flight that went through Paris, where there was less than an hour to connect with a UTA, which is a French international airline flight that flew near Libya to Niamey, Niger, which is a bordering country to Libya, and from Niamey, Niger to Ouagadougou, which is the capital of Burkina Faso. Now, I know to you, Ouagadougou sounds like a remote place, but let me tell you, having been there, and when you go out from there, Ouagadougou becomes the center of civilization and the all representation of comfort and delight and all of the conveniences of the modern world. It really is rather simple. A lot of the places in Burkina Faso are called Dougou because that means the place of. And Ouaga was the greeting that was given by the people that meant welcome. So Ouagadougou is the place of welcome. You remember, you try that on somebody at work tomorrow. They'll know it already, but at least it'll show that you're well informed. We went all around Burkina Faso, and then the last several days that we were there went by Toyota Land Cruiser across the Sahel to Mali, and then subsequently flew out on Friday the 2nd of May out of Ouagadougou to Bamako, Mali, and Dakar, Senegal, and eventually back through New York here to the United States. Well, let's take a look for a few minutes at some pictures, and then if we have a few minutes at the end, maybe we'll have a couple of minutes for some questions. I'm going to take you on a fast tour here. Burkina Faso, the land of upright men. That's rather chauvinistic all by itself, isn't it? The Volta River, from which the country originally got its name, is extremely dry at this dry season of the year before the rains come. It's a country that has a great nationalistic concern, and so the flag is commonly seen throughout the country in government buildings and elsewhere. The city of Ouagadougou is not a modern city by most standards, with comparatively few paved streets other than the main thoroughfares. Once you get outside of the city, which represents the metropolitan area, it's very common to see marketplaces in the villages where people come together to share their goods and to seek to make a little bit of money. It's very common that the means of transport, like much of the third world, is carrying things on your head, whether it be water or food or other things that are there. Women have the responsibility for doing the laundry. We asked the question of why they do it in the sun when it's so terribly hot in the sun, and the man's answer was that if you let women do their laundry in the shade, they will get lazy and will talk too much. Amidst all the difficulty and the hard work, there's time for some fun in terms of dances and singing and the playing of drums and enjoying the simple happinesses of life. Children, well, children are everywhere. School children, children that gathered around us very quickly, children who liked to laugh and were absolutely delightful and fun to be with, but children who also have medical problems and difficulties that we would rarely see here in the United States. A typical home in Burkina Faso or that area of West Africa has several huts like this. If a man has several wives, then each of his wives would have a separate hut in the compound, and at least preteen children would live there in the hut with their mother. The kitchen is not modern by our standards, a simple fire and a few basic utensils that are used for cooking, and the livestock share the bedroom with each member of the family. We traveled by Toyota Land Cruiser, and when we were between villages and places, stopped long enough to find a place in the shade where we could drink some water and have a piece of French bread. The water, as I mentioned, cost as much as $5 a liter in a restaurant, and when you buy it by the case, it was still about $2 for a liter, or approximately a quart. In Waiagea, which is not too far from the Mali border, we stayed in a hotel that was comfortable, really, even by much Western standards. It's an area that has electricity, and the room was air-conditioned, and it was sort of the Hilton of Waiagea. It was great. The baobab tree is a symbol of longevity and strength and hope. It's a tree that has an interesting tradition, or at least folktale, that is known throughout much of Africa. It is said that the tree was, in ancient history, the greatest of all the trees, greater in terms of size, in terms of life expectancy, and the birds would come and they would land in the tree and people would come for its shade, except the tree became proud and arrogant and told the birds they were no longer welcome and people could no longer experience the shade of its branches. As a result of that, God judged it for its arrogance and pride and turned it upside down and made its roots stick up into the air instead of into the ground. And that's kind of the way the baobab tree looks. The bark is used to make rope. The leaves and other parts of the tree are used for medicinal purposes, and it is an integral part of that West African society. Unfortunately, because of the drop of the water table, many of the baobab trees are dying. World Relief's ministry is centered in Dakar, Senegal. However, this is the office headquarters that are in Ouagadougou for the country of Burkina Faso. We went out to Maasai village and went through the elaborate rituals that are part of the culture. First, the elders and the people of the community gather and they come out, and it's necessary for you, before you even meet anyone or drink anyone, or meet anyone, you have to have a drink that is provided. And the drink that was there is provided by water mixed with millet that probably wouldn't go real well at McDonald's or Burger King around here. And everyone has to take a drink, and after you have the drink, then you shake hands, and then you have everyone's names. These are the elders of that particular village. The man in the brown is the political leader of that entire area who came out to greet us and to thank us for the World Relief Project there. And the man in the blue is the pastor of the Assembly of God Church in that particular community. The village is a village that is based upon agriculture, where different types of grains, particularly millet, are grown, and they follow through a very elaborate and difficult process in order to get it to the point where it's edible. Eventually, the idea is to make it edible, but before that, the grain is stored in granaries, and this is a rather typical one all over the place. At the end of the harvest, it's put into this type of granary, and it's stored there until the women take it out. They put it in a mortar and pestle type of setup and break it so that the chaff can be taken away. And then after that, take the grain and stone grind it. And this takes hours of work. World Relief has gone into this Maasai village and built a building and put a diesel-driven mill in. And here is the first day that it's to be operated, where women can have in a few minutes all of the grain ground for an entire week, instead of spending hours every day stone grinding it. It's diesel driven. There is the mill. You put the grain in at the top, and then to the left at the bottom is where the flour comes out. That's